I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. New technologies are combining to change the way we influence our communities. In her book, Momentum, Allison Fine writes about these new technologies and how they are igniting social change in our connected age. Allison is our guest today on Smart City. Also with us are Deepa Naik and Trenton Oldfield, coordinators of This Is Not a Gateway, a thoroughly modern and self-organizing festival of ideas planned for London next October. Unlike organizers of recent big-name U.S. think festivals, Deepa and Trenton are more curious than curatorial. We'll be back with this week's edition of Smart City right after the news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Allison Fine is a successful social entrepreneur and writer dedicated to helping grassroots organizations and activists successfully execute social change efforts. Her book, Momentum, Igniting Social Change in the Connected Age, was the winner of the Terry McAdams National Book Award. She's a senior fellow on the Democracy Team at Demos, a network for change in action in New York City, and was the founder and executive director of Innovation Network. What are we learning, Allison, about how to use the web as a tool for citizen action on public issues?
Well, we're learning an extraordinary number of things, Carol. One thing that I often have to remind people is just how nascent all of this is. We're in the infancy of all of the tools and how we use them. But one thing in particular that we're finding is that individuals can create enormous change working side to side and self-organizing without needing organizations to tell them what to do.
Well, that's fascinating. And of course, it's made possible by technology. So describe some of what you think are the best examples of technology that are enabling citizens to work side by side without top-down organizations to make their action possible.
Well, certainly it's the entire array of what I call social media, Carol, that's making all of this possible. When people talk about technology, too often I think the image that pops into our head are those scary large boxes that sit on desks or sit in cold rooms somewhere that collect all of our personal information. The revolution that I'm talking about is powered by social media, and those are tools like cell phones, and email, and instant messaging, and blogging. And the difference in these tools is that they're very inexpensive, they're very easy to use, and most importantly, they fuel interactivity. So no longer is it a broadcast of someone speaking at us and we're passively sitting on the couch and listening, but it's a conversation that we're engaged in and that we can respond to and help to shape over time.
Of course, the web is an interesting world. It's so rich with so many wonderful things, and yet it is demanding in that it's a conversation and it takes time to participate in conversations. And sometimes it can be hard to find a place that has the conversations you're interested in. What are those sorting mechanisms, Allison, or how do we sort through to make the conversations manageable so that reasonable people who don't devote all day long to this can actually participate in a meaningful way, and B, they can find each other?
There are two very important things that have been going on this past year that specifically speak to the issue and the concerns that you raise. One, in how to find good information and plug yourself into it, and two, how to find communities of people that share your interests. So the first thing that's going on is that the polarity of the web is shifting, Carol, and by that I mean instead of each of us having to go out and search and surf around looking for bits and pieces that we find interesting, we now have tools like, for instance, my favorite is Google Alerts, where we can basically say to the web through a tool like Google, bring me these pieces that I want. So instead of searching for me going out and searching, good information is coming to me. The second thing that's going on is this explosion in social networking sites like Facebook, like TBD, as in tobedetermined.com. That's for people over 40, a social networking site for people over 40. What's happened is the reason why those sites are exploding is that people do have a need and an interest in connecting with people who have like interests to them. And the social networking sites create safe places to do that. And so those are ways to create communities of people based on our need for connectedness that we've always had. We've always had social networks. Now we just have the tools to make them much larger and much easier to manage over time.
What has surprised you about the use of technology to empower the edge?
Boy, that's a great question. I think what surprises me most is the reluctance of, I'll call them more experienced people, to understand the power of what's going on. You know, when I go out and I speak directly in person, Carol, with groups of people, like for instance, last week I was speaking to a gathering of the League of Women Voters. Now, these are people who are passionate about community building and social change in their communities and terrified of the connected age. But when you get very specific and you say, well, okay, who's using a cell phone here? And everybody's hand goes up. Who's using email? Everybody's hand goes up. Who's surfing the web? And I'm trying to relay to them, you are integrally involved in this connected age. And now we just have to get you to think about embracing it instead of being fearful of it.
Is that an age issue?
You know, there's much less of a digital divide right now than a generational divide. You know, kids are intuitively using all of the new tools and growing up, as a friend of mine says, as natives in this digital age. And those of us a bit older are tourists in it. But it really is a terrible shame to let it pass us by when it is so important to social change.
In your experience, which uses of technology have the most to teach us on how to engage more people more deeply in public action?
I think it's blogs, Carol, and I wish there was another term for it. You know, if marketing people had gotten to it first, they would have called it something lovely like roses, but unfortunately the word is blogs, right? So the idea of too many groups, too many organizations I talk to think of a blog as an online brochure. They want to say what they want to say, but they don't really want to engage people in a conversation. The power of blogs to really create conversations and allow people to strategize about issues, to self-organize, and to feel that they have a meaningful role in community change is incredibly powerful. The other tool, when people ask me what's your favorite tool, I sometimes surprise them because my favorite tool is meetup.com, which is not just an online tool, right? It's a website where people can come, pick an interest that they have, which could be political, could be environmental or climate change, or it could be a hobby like knitting, and join a local group that's meeting and meet a group of strangers. And I remember describing this to a friend of mine just a couple of weeks ago, and she looked at me like I had three heads. You mean you want me to go out and just meet with strangers? And I said, yes, I do. And she loves restaurants and cooking and food. And she did it, and she called me and she said it was the best thing she ever did. It would have never occurred to her to open herself up to meeting new people this way. And so the possibilities of engaging people online and on land through a tool like meetup.com are just mind-boggling, really, in their scope and their scale.
Are there technologies being used for commercial purposes that you believe have lessons for those who hope to increase public engagement?
No. I think I spend so much time worrying about when our social media tools begin to be used for commercial purposes, they become less effective for social change purposes. So take a site like Facebook right now, which is working very hard to try to figure out a strategy for becoming commercially successful, as it's become so socially successful. And every time they inch that way, they're pulling away from the power of what's made that site so successful. You know, so wanting to mine the information of users and use it for advertising really lessens the experience of users. So every time that we see a company try to use a viral YouTube video for advertising, I think it takes away the power of video for social change. Certainly, they're going to continue to use the new tools. So what I'm saying is really the polarity has really shifted, that it used to be that social change folks would try to grab commercial tools and use them for our purposes in social change. And what we've seen over the last 2 years is that commercial entities, particularly advertising groups, are trying to figure out all this power in social networking and trying to take advantage of it. And every time they do that, every time they treat people who are engaged in social networks as direct mail recipients, I think we lose power.
I think about eBay. It provides a platform for buyers and sellers, for people to make commercial transactions. If you think about it, it's a benign platform, and without buyers and sellers, there would be no transaction, there would be no value. If it were simple to post needs and get those needs met, or post opportunities and get those met in an eBay-type platform, I can imagine that really having positive results for cities and for public engagement. Are there other technologies where you can take what exists today for commercial transactions that you think could be adopted in a way that would fit very nicely with public engagement, public action, in a far more comprehensive and dynamic way than what currently exists?
I think, you know, eBay is a really fascinating case study, Carol. And when Piero Omidyar, the founder of eBay, talks about what he's proudest of, he always mentions that it would have been unimaginable 10 years ago, 15 years ago, to create an opportunity for perfect strangers to trust one another. He doesn't talk about the commerce that happens. He really talks about the issue of building trust between strangers. And I think it's a marvelous thing, and it's a wonderful opportunity to show the possibilities, as you were mentioning, of how this can be used for community building and for social change efforts. I think the limitation there is that it is a vehicle for commerce, so it isn't a vehicle for social change. But when we are looking for how could we bring neighborhoods together, for instance, to talk about planning and zoning and, say, climate change, issues that affect everybody that live in a neighborhood, but where we don't often have a wide and diverse number of voices that are really discussing these issues and coming to public policy outcomes. And there, I would say, certainly, we have the social networking platforms technologically that can be used to engage people in that conversation. What we desperately need for social change is leadership, whether it's individuals or organizations, that are facilitating those conversations. That's the critical piece that we don't talk about enough, right? Is that there's too often a feeling that if you just build the technology platform, these conversations are going to just arise. If we build it, they'll come. And they don't. Social change doesn't actually work that way. We can engage lots and lots of people in conversations, but they're not going to move public policy forward. They're not going to make positive social change on the ground unless we have exceptional leadership and the opportunity and the sort of fortitude, the resilience to have those conversations over time, because social change takes time.
Yes, it does. Although technology can certainly accelerate the impact, and we've seen that quite dramatically, which of today's political campaigns, in your opinion, are doing the best job of using the web to engage supporters?
Well, certainly the Obama campaign has engaged lots and lots of people, particularly young people, and to self-organize locally and to raise money. And the Edwards campaign has used a wide variety of social networking tools to connect supporters both locally and across across the country as well. But I have been a little bit disappointed, Carol, that all of the campaigns understand that they have to use the new media to engage people. But there really hasn't been a campaign that's pushed power to the edges the way that we saw the Dean campaign do in 04. Now, the Dean campaign did it because the campaign at its grassroots kind of took over the campaign for a while. Through 2003, it was really the campaign leading the candidate, not the other way around. And except maybe for Ron Paul this time, who has such a strong web presence, we really haven't seen that happen as much as I thought we were going to.
What are the downsides of making self-organization possible?
Well, I should warn you, you're talking to a digital utopian, so I personally don't see many downsides. you know, self-organizing is as powerful a motivation for social change as you can find, Carol. That really is the essence of the power that really drives people to really care about issues and to push for policy change or changes in the way that business happens, which is what we're seeing a lot with climate change right now. The only caution I raise is with organizations, that the world is changing very, very quickly, and if they're going to continue to think in terms of the broadcast era and be very top-down and hierarchical, they're going to become irrelevant. They're not going to go out of business today or tomorrow. They'll continue to raise their money through direct mail. But over time, particularly as younger people who are so immersed in social media become more active and become donors, they're going to become less and less relevant over time. And they really have to think about moving from talking at groups of people to building constituencies and having conversations to be successful.
How do you balance those two things, or can you? Once you empower the edge, is it simply out of the control of a central organizational force to keep the edge in check?
Well, you know, that's the central question for people who are running social change organizations right now. And my advice to them is that even though we're living with revolutionary tools, I think they can move in an evolutionary manner to engage in this new way of working. So, they have to make payroll, and I understand that. There's a lot of pressure on mature organizations to maintain what they are doing well and, frankly, to stay alive, and they have staff to pay. So I really encourage them to find discrete projects to try out working this way. So it may be instead of determining that your spring fundraiser is going to be a dinner dance this year, how about engaging a community of people in a conversation about what are the different ways that we could raise money this spring? We have to meet our revenue goals. That's immutable. But maybe people out there have ideas we haven't thought of how we could go about raising money. There's a group in the UK that runs something called Red Nose Day to raise money for children with cancer. And instead of Red Nose Day being one thing, being a walk or a dinner to raise money, it is whatever people who engage in Red Nose Day want it to be, and it ends up being tens of different ways of raising money. And they raise about $125 million in one day every year working that way. So I really encourage groups to find one project, one place to test the waters and try it out so it doesn't feel so scary. You're not throwing the baby out with the bathwater. And they can really live it for a little while in one project and feel the difference, feel what happens when instead of trying to drag volunteers along, which anyone who's been engaged in social change can sometimes have felt when we wanted them to do just what we wanted them to do, now to engage people in all of the power that they bring in their creativity and their social networks and their contacts and their passion, and take it out for a walk one day and try it out.
Certainly the web has enabled us to think and act globally in ways we never have before. It seems sometimes that there's a glamour or cachet in acting globally versus working on things that are closer to home. Have you noticed the same thing? And if so, what do you think we need to make causes closer to home have more appeal, more cachet?
Again, I think this is a leadership issue. I think that we need, again, whether it's individuals or people working in local government or in local nonprofit organizations, we need people who can articulate a pathway for change that can get people engaged and then using social media tools, keeping them engaged over time. But it really requires having that face-to-face interaction to build trust with people, to give them a sense that the intentions are real for solving real problems. Because I think it's, you know, we've all become, I think, a bit inured to hearing people say that they want change, but then not following through. So that's, you know, the pressure is on local leaders to really create pathways of change that can engage people and create an intention of actually engaging people in real and authentic ways.
Allison Fine is author of Momentum, Igniting Social Change in the Connected Age. The latest news in the world of urban planning, design, and development comes to us from PlanEdison assistant editor Nate Berg.
Preserve historic buildings or build parking lots? What to do? Preservationists and concerned citizens in the central California city of Stockton say preserve historic buildings, but city councilors and the city's redevelopment director say parking is the prudent choice. According to the Stockton Record, 127 parking spaces could be created by demolishing as many as 7 historic hotels in downtown Stockton, a possibility the city sees as a boon to help out its downtown merchants. But the preservationists say that the hotels are too valuable a part of the city's history to be destroyed. Built between 1870 and 1930, the hotels were all closed in 2001 after they failed to pass code inspections. The city says the cost of preserving the dilapidated hotels far outweighs their historic value, and the city council voted last month to tear 4 of them down. But the preservationists are not giving up, and have now filed a lawsuit against the city, ensuring a long and drawn-out battle over parking lots and preservation. Meanwhile, in New Orleans, the broken city is trying to preserve itself, but is having a pretty hard time. As the city slowly recovers, a major issue is holding it back: the low supply of rental housing. According to the New York Times, more than half of the city's households were rented before the storm, and many of those had to be evacuated and demolished. Now, the shortage of housing has kicked rental prices to almost 2 times what they were before Katrina, leaving many unable to afford what little is available, and doubling the city's homeless population. And with the Federal Emergency Management Agency planning to phase out its emergency trailer camps by the end of May, 900 more families will be on the hunt for housing in the city. But with a demand that is already overwhelming, few expect the city's housing supply will be able to keep up come May. And finally, 2 property owners in Boulder, Colorado have a little less space to call their own now, after neighbors partially occupied part of their property long enough for the courts to grant them partial ownership. The Los Angeles Times reported recently on the land acquisition, which is legal in many states under what is called adverse possession. By demonstrating occupancy for long enough, legal rights to land can be acquired. But for the property owners who lost some of their peace, and for many in their community, ethics are more important than legal precedent, and the resulting protests over the land grab show little signs of dissipating. For PlanEdison, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is assistant editor of PlanEdison.com. After a short break, we'll talk to 2 young Londoners who are planning a major festival of ideas in October. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Deepa Naik's work has focused on cross-cultural contemporary art practice and community activism. She works both as an artist and an educator. Trenton Oldfield is coordinator of the TEMS strategy, Q to Chelsea. He was project manager of Cityside Regeneration in London. Together, they coordinate This Is Not a Gateway, based in London, and plan to stage a major festival of ideas in the city in October 2008 and every other year thereafter. You write that This Is Not a Gateway is an organization that will bring together young people living and working in Europe whose main preoccupation is the city. Who are these people?
And it's basically anybody whose point of reference in their work or their thoughts is the city. We do have some headings which sort of groups people, if you like, if it's necessary. So when we put together the multidisciplinary approaches, they exist. But it ranges from designers, architects, planners, which is probably the most obvious. I mean, to public servants, policy and regeneration workers, people that work in urban renewal, writers, journalists, academics, novelists, people who write for fanzines, people whose production is through the written word, as well as activists, human rights, social justice campaigners, people that are campaigning in the city, if you like, interested in migration issues. Also, artists, people whose work as filmmakers, musicians, photographers, playwriters, etc. The point of departure is the city. And also, we know a number of people in Northern Europe who are young people with that are politicians in a city, that have inner city constituencies. So that's the kind of the range of people, and they're coming from all different approaches, but the point of that brings them all together is that their point of departure in their work is the city.
Deepa, do these people naturally see themselves as connected?
Well, this is actually one of the kind of defining course. I guess part of our ethos is actually to bring people across disciplines who might not necessarily engage with each other, but are sort of working in silos, so to speak. So architects who might not necessarily connect with an artist, but in fact their practices somehow have themes that can go across disciplines. So in that sense, the whole idea is to sort of break down those sort of boundaries which we all seem to function within.
No, I don't think many of them see themselves as connected. I don't think many of them even consider other approaches. I mean, the ones that are most often criticized for that are architects who, are focused on objects and not so much on the city. For example, those in their conceptual, sociologist approach to the city. So no, I don't, directly answering that, no, and what we're interested in exploring is what will happen as a result of bringing those people together.
What is it about the city, then, that you think, in fact, will bring them together, will demonstrate to them that they have interests in common and that they can be motivated by the same thing?
I think it's the ability to answer questions that will draw people to the festival. That's the approach where we're not prescribing an overall kind of curatorial agenda, or we don't have an agenda. So it's people who are wanting to explore, who are kind of adventurers, I guess, that are wanting to find out other information. And I imagine from that point, from those early points, we hope to do this for a long time. That early point of those people that are exploratory will become quite compelling, and lots of other people will then become interested as a result of what starts to come out of that. But in the beginning, it will be the avant-garde, I guess, or the explorer, the adventurer.
You're planning a festival soon. Tell me about what you're planning and what you imagine happening at that festival.
So it's still very early days for us. I don't know if you know, but we've only been running since late summer, July, August. We haven't yet put out a public call for the festival. Basically, the festival will be held right across London, taking over spaces in the city that aren't being used. Cafes after hours, community buildings, galleries, restaurants, parks, bars, and so on, to hold workshops, film screenings, and use readings, roundtables, and more. So we've put, so as I was saying, we haven't yet put out a public call, but we've already started to get proposals in, just sort of word of mouth at this point, which is really exciting. So we don't yet have a program set, but we're starting to kind of see the themes that are emerging, which is really interesting. And one of them seems to be social justice and human rights. Ecology is coming up. People who are working on housing are getting in touch. And again, they're sort of proposing a range of activities, from roundtable discussions to exhibitions and so on.
And do you intend to document everything that is said and compile it and bring it back to both those who attend and a broader network?
Yeah, I mean, one of our bigger ambitions for the whole This Is Not a Gateway project is to start influencing policy, as well as to sort of create an archive that works along the same sort of ethos of a cross-disciplinary approach. So everything that we do, we run salons, which happen every 2 months, for example, leading up to the festival, and all the festival activities will be documented either digitally, either audio, video. We commissioned post-workshop, post-salon essays, and that all will become archived in online, so it'll be a database that uses a cross-disciplinary approach again for searching. So if someone puts in a search, say, ecology in the city, they might get a range of films, they might get some texts, they might get a photography project, for example, and so on. But also there'll be a book, a print book, that'll hopefully come out in about 6 months after the festival, and that we want to disseminate into libraries, into universities, into architectural practices, and go from there.
Yeah, we see that as that is where all the questions that have been asked in the festival will be distilled and will then form the program for the following year. So the publication, the post-festival publication, which we plan to do in a kind of an academic format, we want it to go into that sort of environment, will then form the questions for the next festival that will be running, you know, six months later once it's published.
I'm curious, you mentioned Trenton young people earlier. Are there age limits on who you expect to participate in This Is Not a Gateway?
No, not at all. It's we're interested in people that are emerging in their fields, where I guess we could say we're not interested in people that are established, that are already in the established circuits. We're interested in people that are coming up, so that they might not, as a result, they might be, you know, older people who have changed disciplines and now their work is preoccupied with the city. So they might, it's not about age, it's about sort of the position that they're in that kind of, that when you're younger or you have that rawness or that naivety of your questions, but they're also, you know, very interesting questions, and they come with an intensity that we're interested in.
What was your impulse for creating This Is Not a Gateway?
I just really enjoy bringing people together on a kind of a really basic level. And I think next year in the European Union, it's the year of intercultural dialogue, European year of intercultural dialogue. So I think that's sort of part of the ethos of just bringing people together to chat together, to eat together, to, you know, party together, to get to know each other on a kind of a you know, basic human level. But it's on a more kind of sophisticated level, if you like. It's about creating sort of arenas and stages and platforms for emerging voices, for people that are not necessarily interested in. But my the inspiration was that currently at the moment, certainly in the European context, in the UK context, there's a pretty much a sort of a sewn up group of people that are deciding policies about cities. And I think as we're moving in towards most people living in cities, we need a much more comprehensive approach. There was a big conference here last week called the Thames Gateway Forum, which is looking at an area in East London. Unless you work for a large organisation, you would not be even able to afford to be able to go in and have any access to that discussion. It's financially impossible, so it's already excluding people. So we're wanting to sort of break up that hegemony and that kind of, and bring some life to these discussions about, you know, what's happening in cities that is kind of innovative and a little bit of rascal, get a bit of energy into things instead of having, you know, these kind of quite staged corporate approaches to the city.
You call yourselves coordinators, not gatekeepers. What's the difference?
Basically, we're not gatekeepers in the sense that we're not curators, and we make that position very clear from the start. We're organizers. We're going to be putting out an open call for proposals. We're going to figure out what sort of infrastructure people require of us to set up in order that they can then hold the exhibitions that they want to hold or workshops they want to hold. So we're very much in the kind of ethos of self-organization, self-initiative working methods. So we're not here to say you have to fit in with this theme. This year's theme, for example, is water, and we're only interested in projects that relate to that. Instead, we're sort of, I mean, our main curiosity and drive is to see what questions are emerging and to create the arenas that those questions can surface. There's so much interesting things that are happening that actually don't have the space. We don't have the
stage.
For other people to engage with.
One of our steering committee members sort of summarized it at a meeting, and he said, "We're building the stage for the performers."
Mm-hmm.
And that's how we see our role.
So we're sort of not writing the plays. We're actually just creating the arenas that people can then take that and I guess it's really about learning for us. So we are in a position to see what's driving people, what new knowledge is being produced in and on cities that we can then disseminate to a broader audience.
I'm curious, are there themes that you personally, the two of you, would be disappointed if they don't emerge?
It's really, on a very personal level, I don't know if I would say that there are things that I would be disappointed if they didn't happen necessarily, but there are things that I'm really curious about. I think we both have kind of personal invested interests in certain things. For me, it's issues of ownership, of urban space, of immigration, of social justice. Those are very, in terms of my other work, very integral to my thinking. Trenton?
Yes, I think that it will take a number of years for it to evolve. The first couple of years is largely going to be by word of mouth. We don't have huge budgets for kind of communication. We're wanting it to be word of mouth. We want it to build its credibility over time as a result of sort of, I guess, whispering, if you like. So in the first couple of years, I don't have any real expectations. I don't think we have any real expectations for its early stage other than it's growing and that the people that are attending as participants are stimulated and sound worthwhile.
That seems like a really appealing and yet risky strategy, in that we're in a world today where a new technology is introduced and it either takes off quickly or it doesn't. And if it doesn't take off quickly, it's sort of shunted to the sideline and we're on to the next thing. And it's interesting that you think you can build in a slow way by whispering in effect.
Just to sort of clarify that, first of all, we run a series of bi-monthly salons, which are our testing ground. So every 2 months, we sort of present a question. We invite different people from different fields to come and unpick it. We commission a post-salon essay, which is a very mini form of what we hope will happen across London next October. And you know, we've really been surprised. We have a very small mailing list, and somehow we've been able to attract audiences of about 50 to 60 people in a very small space, and have we just quite.
I think we're talking to you, so the word is getting out. But I think what's fundamental is the integrity to the project, and mm-hmm. that it's not prescribed, that it is facilitated, and we're also prepared for it to fail. We don't. I mean, failing is a positive thing as well. I don't expect it will fail, but the integrity to the project is important.
And I think for us as well, it's just getting a core group of participants that are thinking along the same lines as we are and are curious and just sort of upward. We're not really interested in having something for the masses necessarily, rather a small group of interested, engaged participants.
Is it your hope to impact the careers of the participants by showcasing their work or the cities in which they work, or both?
Yes, I mean, some of the elements of the festival will not just be sort of people presenting projects. We hope to do a lot of workshop based around things that we've been very lucky to have had support recently with, in terms of how do you get things moving, specific workshops on how do you get published, how do you get your PhD published, how do you get your art book published, really, and then for sort of the younger audience, how do you get involved in urban regeneration if you want, if you're thinking of studying this. So there'll be a mixture between really academic projects and kind of, I guess, vocational approach as well, where there'll be really tangible
tools
that people will learn.
But also, our whole idea is just to get people talking to each other, that there's so much interesting things that are happening in London, but that are also happening in Denmark, in Berlin, in Croatia. And so if an architect, for example, who's working in London and has perhaps like an ecological architectural practice, might be able to link up with someone somewhere else in Europe and engage. I mean, if that ends up being something that helps their career, that's fantastic.
There is a percentage which we haven't defined that will be skills-based, will be developing skills and direct knowledge.
When do you intend to put your call out for proposals?
Early in the new year, since we've been bedding down the organizational infrastructure, and the new year we'll be launching it.
You say that you're unconcerned with gloss and kudos or high visibility. Is that a clever strategy to acquire kudos and high visibility?
No. No, both Deepa and I are quite shy, reserved, kind of behind the scenes people. So yeah, no, definitely not. It's always about quality and integrity. Mm-hmm. It's not about visibility. I mean, we really don't want, a big all singing, all dancing festival. We want, good quality people getting together, having good conversations that go back, talk to their friends and colleagues and say, I went to this really, really interesting thing in London this year. I don't really know what it was all about, but it was amazing.
Tell me the dates again.
It's the 24th.
The 27th of October 2008.
When you think about your salons, have they in fact been the kinds of discussions, have they had that energy and fresh voice that you're seeking in the festival itself?
Definitely. Undoubtedly. That's definitely been the feedback that we've got. The emails we've had of people sort of saying, this is what that we need. I mean, the editor of the architecture journal, wrote to us specifically and said, this format, this approach is exactly what's needed.
It's very encouraging for us because, we talked for many, many hours and we had this idea and we set up this website. In fact, you were one of the first people to contact us in the very, very early stages of the project. And in the about 6 months since we've started, it's really grown in momentum and has drawn such an interesting range of people who are really, the people are creating the energy and creating the buzz and the questions and the atmosphere of these salons have been really productive environments. It's somehow a splash between a university seminar and a community hall, if you will.
Picnic.
A picnic. I like that. Just one more question. You've written that there is a need to find an enjoyable way. I love that. An enjoyable way of disrupting what you call this dull hegemony. What constitutes that, and how can it, in fact, be disrupted?
Well, I think the idea of, one, even bringing people together from across Europe is enjoyable. So, you know, eating together, drinking together, lots of people being strangers is enjoyable, but having a kind of a point of reference and sort of nourishing that knowledge and it really being knowledge-based is very nourishing, and nourishing often means enjoyable. But I think, and by the nature of the people that will be coming, I mean, the 3-4 days before our festival in Barcelona is the World Architecture Festival, which is the complete opposite. I mean, it's the you know, star architects, it's the property developers, it's literally the opposite end of the scale of what we're doing. And I think it's as a result of sort of germinating these ideas in people, it will become even more stark. You know, something like the World Architecture Festival, which is paid for and organized by EMAP, which is the big publishing company, mm-hmm. for sort of architectural magazines.
But ultimately, you want to influence policy. So you want to influence the kinds of people who will be at the World Architecture Forum and the people who take their lead from forums like that, that seem important, that have, quote, important people, recognized people attached to them. How do you think you make that? How do you bridge that gap?
Well, my experience with those people is they're like hoovers for information. They're sort of, because they're often detached from the ground, they're actually crying out for this information that's on the ground that we'll be generating. And, you know, most academics get a fair amount of information from their students. And I think that level of what we'll be producing will be rich, rich material for them. So I think it will, you know, they're very good at finding that level of information.
Deepa Naik and Trenton Oldfield coordinate This Is Not a Gateway. As we head into this holiday season, CityView's commentator Walker Smith has a gift he'd like to share with you.
I developed type 1 diabetes the year after I graduated from college. My life was pretty undisciplined then. I ate poorly and slept odd hours, and I was too busy with grad school and late nights to bother with exercise. I weighed more than I ever had before or ever have since. I was taking my health for granted, and it finally caught up with me. Many people have lived like this without getting diabetes, including all of my equally undisciplined friends at the time. I just happened to be predisposed to it, and my lifestyle was the trigger. I had all the symptoms of uncontrolled high blood sugar for weeks before I finally went to a doctor who knew right away that I had diabetes. In an instant, I had to change my lifestyle. I had to become more focused on diet, exercise, sleep, and stress management. I couldn't throw caution to the wind the way I had before, because if I did, I was guaranteeing myself bigger problems and complications down the road. Over time, I have learned a lot about managing diabetes. It took some experimentation to figure out how my body metabolizes foods and how exercise affects my response to insulin. But I found that with information and good discipline, I could keep diabetes under control. As a result, my life acquired a discipline that it never had before. Diabetes, as hard and as risky as it is, gave me this gift, the gift of discipline. I have come to appreciate this as a real bonus in my life. Diabetes has been the best thing that ever happened to me. Without it, I would never have developed the discipline that has made it possible for me to be successful in every aspect of my life. Now, my experience with diabetes might strike you as just another story about turning lemons into lemonade. But this is exactly the kind of story that is relevant to all of us nowadays. Certain events are offering us the same gift that diabetes gave to me, and our future success depends entirely upon our willingness to develop the discipline needed to meet the challenges ahead. I'm thinking of climate change and global warming. Many scientists feel that it is too late now to head it off. Global warming has begun and will continue to worsen for many years to come, regardless of what we do. As some scientists argue, we are past the point of prevention, and thus face a future of mitigation, or of coping with what's ahead. But this is not bad. Indeed, it is a gift. Either way, prevention or mitigation, we face the same necessity I faced when I developed diabetes. We must adopt more discipline in our lifestyles in order to survive. Conservation and moderation must replace excess and overconsumption. The worst is upon us, yet it offers us a fresh chance to be our best. We should embrace it with glee, because it is offering the gift of discipline to us all. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta, and his new book is Generation Ageless. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.